Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, this is Chronicles and Commons, and in this episode I want to talk about the big island of Oriab. Oriab is a location in the H.P. Lovecraft Dreamland realm. It appears in the quest for the unknown, the dream quest for the unknown Caedith, and it is located in the Southern Sea, which if you listened to the previous episode, the previous H.P. Lovecraft episode of this series, you'll know a little bit about the Southern Sea already. It's got a bunch of nations in it that we don't know a whole lot about. It's got a sunken city, and it feeds into, or it is one of the cities on it is the Dilithlene, the port city Dilithlene. So the River Skye dumps into Oriab next to Dilithlene, and then Dilithlene is kind of the gateway to the rest of the Southern Sea, at least if you're coming from the Enchanted Woods and the countryside containing Ulthar and so on. So that's where we are. It's about 10 days from Dilithlene by boat to Oriab. And when you're approaching Oriab, you can see the Mount Granach from at least if you're approaching, I think it is east, from the east. At least that's my calculation. The cardinal directions are a little bit wonky in the Dreamland realm, but from what I can gather from H.P. Lovecraft's source text, if you're approaching the island from the by the east, by way of the Southern Sea from Dilithlene, then you'll see the great Mount Granach. And at the foot of Granach lies a city called Baharnath. Now, Mount Granach itself is, well, we'll go into it in detail in a moment, but I will say that it is legendary. It is said that the gods themselves, when they did live on Earth, favored Granach, and they would stay on Granach and dance there by moonlight. And today there is supposedly a great image of a god carved on solid rock, way, way up, high up in Granach. Whether or not that actually exists, we will find out soon. The island of Oriab is famous for its fragrant resin, which people gather from its inner groves, for delicate pottery baked by artisans of Baharna, and intricate figures carved from Mount Granach's ancient lava. An ancient tradition that's carried on even today is image making. Again, H.P. Lovecraft in the source text isn't super clear on what image making is, so very little is known of this art. We do know that lava gatherers and hill people know this ancient art quite well. I assume there may be some old magic involved in the process. What exactly it is, I don't know. And since the source text is not clear about it, we could certainly muse about it ourselves, and we will in a little while once we get to Granach. But first, let's talk about Baharna, because Baharna is really your entry point, assuming you're coming from Dilithlene. The port town of Baharna is approximately 2 days in front of, from where you're entering the island, in front of Granach, by zebra. So the wharves of Baharna are of porphyry, and the city rises in great stone terraces behind them, having streets of steps that are frequently arched over by buildings and bridges between buildings. There's a great canal under the whole city as well, a tunnel with granite gates that lead to the inland lake of Yath, Y-A-T-H. And then on the opposite shore of Yath are vast clay brick ruins of a primal city whose name is not remembered. So Baharna structurally is a multi-level city. It sort of slopes upward as the island itself slopes upward. And then even on top of that, so not only do you have, you know, roads sort of going up and then up and then up, so stair-step roads, but in addition to that, you have buildings and bridges connecting these buildings. So you've got this vertical maze of roads and bridges and multi-level buildings that probably have multiple ground floors. You know, there's a ground floor to get to the lower street, and then there's another ground floor, a couple of floors up to get to the next street up. You know, so it's multi-level city, and I think that's kind of unique, and it would be a lot of fun to play in, because if you're a character in this world, then maybe you're being attacked from up high, and in order to get up to where your attackers are, you'll have to, maybe you can dart into a building and hurry up to their level to try to jump them from behind, or maybe you can swing up on an awning and try to leap up to the next level up. You know, it would be a lot of fun, and I think you know, unless you've got flying creatures in your campaign, the vertical space in D&D is often ignored, and I think part of that is because of sort of fear for having to calculate so many different directions. You know, it's a lot easier to just say, okay, there's a zombie 5 feet in front of you. Simple. But now if you say, okay, well, there's a thug in front of you and five archers above you shooting arrows at you, what do you do? Now you have to kind of keep track of, okay, the X and the Y coordinates. But I mean, gosh, it's got to be fun, especially if you're a rogue type of person who, or just a good climber for that matter, you know, who can take advantage of that vertical space and actually climb up a wall or something cool like that. I think it'd be pretty neat. So anyway, back to the port. So the harbor of Baharna, there are at the opening of the harbor are two twin beacons called Thon and Thal. That's Thon and Thal. And they gleam to welcome incoming ships into the port of Baharna, and in the night all the windows of Baharna's terraces glitter and glimmer along with the stars until the steep and climbing seaport becomes one glittering constellation hung between the stars of heaven and the reflections of those stars in the still harbor. So we don't really know what Thon and Thal are. We don't know if they're living statues, if they are just really grandiose names for lighthouses, if they're just statues that maybe get lit with, you know, by a torch brigade every night or something. Who knows? We don't know. So they're there, Thon and Thal. They greet the ships coming into the harbor of Baharna, and then the harbor itself is made of porphyry, and it's kind of the lowest point of the city. The original part of Baharna is built of brick that resembles the ruins of the decaying buildings across the shore of Yath. This old town can be reached through back alleys and forgotten streets. And in the old town, back here in this sort of original part of Baharna, the old part of Baharna, is an old tavern. H.P. Lovecraft doesn't provide this tavern with a name, which is mildly inconvenient because speaking about one tavern out of probably several in Baharna, a little bit inconvenient to have nothing to call it, but we could call it Old Baharna Tavern or whatever you want. But it's a notable tavern because the keeper of the tavern is a very, very old man, and he himself inherited the tavern from his great-grandfather, I'm pretty sure. Could be even further back than that, but the tavern's been in the family for a very long time, and it has an interesting claim to fame. That is, that if you go into an upper room of this tavern, and presumably if you know where to look, although the text isn't super clear on how hidden this is, I imagine it's quite hidden because the tavern keeper has to show Randolph Carter, the narrator of the Cadeth book, he has to, you know, he takes him up and shows him this drawing, sort of to suggest, I think, that it's not something that you're just going to stumble across necessarily. Now, on the other hand, it could have just been that the tavern keeper just, you know, Carter hadn't rented the right room to see this drawing, so the tavern keeper just took him up to show him. But anyway, in the clay wall of one of the upper rooms, there is a crude picture. I assume it's like an etching. Yeah, it's scratched into the clay wall, and it is supposed to be a picture of the picture up in the highest parts of Granic. So in theory, this is a picture of the face of God, and not, you know, when we say it's a face of God, it's not. It isn't like when Rembrandt drew or Doré drew the face of God as they imagine it. This is supposed to be the actual face of an actual God. So it's a big deal. However, there's some doubt about how accurate and authentic this scratching is. But it's supposed to have been someone scratched this representation of what they saw on the mountain into the wall. Now, I've got to imagine that this scratching, that this little bit of graffiti is, I mean, since it is, from what I can gather, a point of pride for this tavern. It's a little bit of a claim to fame, but I feel like it's got to be sort of an underground claim to fame. You know, not everyone comes to look at the face of God, and I think that if they just showed it to everybody or just left it out for everyone to see, it would seem a little bit less significant. So I've got to imagine that it would be something that, you know, it's sort of squirreled away in an upper room, and maybe it's, maybe there's been a wardrobe pulled in front of it very intentionally, or maybe there's even a sideboard sort of covering it that comes off if you know to try. So I feel like it's got to be a little bit of a concealed gem for this hotel, and furthermore, I think you could even expand on that maybe not have the tavern owner show them this, your players this picture, or your character this picture, and maybe have your character of your story or whatever discover it on their own, or encourage your players to, you know, somehow get them to discover that, and then who knows what else they're going to discover. Because sure, the tavern owner knows about this one picture of a face of God, but I wonder what else is behind these sideboards, or behind that wardrobe, or under the floorboards, whatever. It could be quite extensive. Could be good, could be bad. It's up to you. Okay, so behind Baharna, so if you keep traveling, you know, if you travel out of Baharna away from the water, you'll be traveling towards Granic, and you'll travel along the road by Yath's shore. The inland region features rolling hills and pleasant orchards with tiny little stone farmhouses dotting the path. These eventually give way to the nameless ancient ruins on Yath's farthest shore. The ruins are said to be haunted or in some way dangerous, so travelers are discouraged from camping there. This is very clear in the book. The haunting is real. If you are dumb enough to camp in the ruins, then you will probably encounter some kind of creature from beyond the grave. So I didn't bother statting anything out for that because it's pretty run of the mill, but I think that would be a fun location to explore. I mean, who doesn't love an old, abandoned, haunted, forgotten city? It's perfect. Uphill through wilder and partly wooded country are the huts of charcoal burners and camps of resin gatherers. Remember, I said that one of Baharna's main exports was resin gathered from the inland groves. The air in this region is fragrant with balsam, and the Maga birds sing blithely as they flash their seven colors in the sun. Maga birds, I don't know what those are. They are not really described much in the book. So I assume they're just birds, i.e., they're not monsters that you would have to fight. But hey, if you want a monster to fight, we have those. So there's a local wild beast around this area, and further towards Granik, but I'll go ahead and mention it now because there's a lake over here. But I assume there's got to be a lake or a river going up to Granik as well because it's mentioned later. But there's a local wild beast called the Vunith. It's an amphibious beast, Vunith, Voonith, and it's often heard howling distantly in the night, in and around this region. Now, while horrific, Vuniths do not dare approach the slope of Granik itself. So as long as your players get from Baharna to Granik in one day, which it's very like, well, I can't imagine how they would do that. I mean, they could, I'm sure, but it's stated quite clearly in the text that it's 2 days zebra ride from Baharna to Granik. So the chances of getting from one to the other in one 24-hour period is or even 12-hour period is quite unlikely. So as if they do, then they won't have to worry about the Vuniths, and as long as they don't camp at the city by Yath, they won't have to worry about ghosts and undead. But if they are not able to do that, then they will probably have to worry about both ghosts and the Vuniths. So we don't really actually get anything beyond the phrase the terrible and horrific Vunith. That's the only thing we have to go on when trying to imagine what a Vunith may be. With that little to go on, it's either an area ripe for just coming up with anything you want, or for just throwing something really obvious into the mix. And I kind of felt like the super obvious one with minimal modification would be a Sahuagin, Sahuagin, from pretty much any monster manual or bestiary that you pick up. I mean, it's in the D&D Monster Manual 5th edition, it's in the Pathfinder Bestiary, so it's a pretty common sort of D&D monster. It might be a little bit too literal. I mean, like I'm really taking the idea of a terrible, horrific, amphibious creature called a Vunith and just sort of going to the most obvious thing. So this might be, almost too literal in a weird way, but it's still probably worth looking at. And if you've got the Monster Manual from 5th edition, then it's on page 263. And if you've got the Bestiary from Pathfinder from Paizo, it's on page 239. And they're both pretty similar, regardless of which version you look at. The Pathfinder art looks a little bit more, I guess, fantastic or something, and the D&D one looks a little bit more horrific. So I'll just read the one out of the 5th edition, or I'll go over it briefly. And it says, so their flavor text is, "Across fog-shrouded coasts where endless ocean swells, an ominous drone sounds on a conch shell, chilling the blood of all who hear it. This is the sound of the Sahuagin hunting horn, a call to raid and battle. Coastal settlers refer to Sahuagin as sea devils." And that's pretty much what they look like. I mean, they kind of look like really muscly fish with legs and arms. So they are lawful evil creatures, armor class of 12, hit points 22, so that's hit die of 4d8 plus 4, speed 30 feet, swim 40 feet. Strength 13, dex 11, constitution 12, intelligence 12, wisdom 13, charisma of 9. Skills, perception plus 5, senses, dark vision 120 feet, passive perception 15, languages, Sahuagin, and a challenge rating of 1/2. They've got a couple of different special feats that they can use, including a blood frenzy. The Sahuagin has advantage on melee attack rolls against any creature that doesn't have all its hit points. That's pretty cool. Limited amphibiousness. The Suhooligan can breathe air and water, but it needs to be submerged at least once every 4 hours to avoid suffocating. And I kind of like that one. That feels like what a Vuneth would probably be, because I don't get the sense that Vuneth just wander the land all over the place, because certainly the narrator doesn't run into one. So I kind of get that they really are amphibious in the sense that I think of what it means to be amphibious, you know, that you really do dwell both in the water and on land. Interestingly, they also have shark telepathy. I don't think that really fits in with the Lovecraft universe, but I mean, it could. You could do that, especially if you have a nautical campaign that you're running and you want the Vuneth to be an enemy. They've got a couple of actions, and the one that I would probably go for is the multi-attack. It makes two melee attacks, one with its bite and one with its claws. Now, in any bestiary or monster manual, you're going to find that the Suhooligan, certainly they're an armed race, so they would have something like spears or tritons or something. Is that what they're called? Tritons? The three-pronged things? Whatever they are. And again, I don't think that really aligns with Lovecraft, or at least not in the sense, I mean, it does with some of his characters, but not the Vuneths. I really got from the text, again, pretty arbitrarily, to be honest, because he's not very specific about it, but I got from the text, personally, that they weren't armed. They were just a creature, just a wandering, or not wandering, creature who will not go up to the slope of Granach, luckily. Okay, so beyond this region is the land of the Lava Gatherers. Lava Gatherers are just people from Oriab who had it chosen for them that their life was going to be spent gathering lava. They tend to keep on the move because they have to follow the flows of lava, or they're searching for ancient deposits of lava. And you can find some of their abandoned villages littering the lower slopes of Granach. As I say, the Lava Gatherers, like, their main goal isn't super clear. Like, I'm not 100% clear on what they do with all the lava that they gather. It's not terribly explicit about what it is that they need all that lava for. It is mentioned a couple of times here and there that they use the lava for carvings and for trinkets, for little statues, little collectible things that people might put on their shelves, or they might use as worship items like icons or fetishes or totems for whatever kind of religious ceremony they want. So I gather that it's in part an export. It is something that is unique to that region. People don't usually get that kind of coarse rock, you know, from anywhere else. So it's considered sort of cool, and it's from Oriab, and it's kind of, you know, I mean, it's just the same way that people pick up rocks off of Hawaii, you know, and bring it back home and show people their little porous, reddish, blackish rock or sand or whatever they've collected, because it's cool, it's different, it's unique. So I think there is some of that. I think it begs, though, to be more than just a collectible. You know, it really wants to have something some magical property, or something about it needs to be significant. And I think that's pretty simple. I mean, you can certainly just have them, because they are image makers. That's part of what they do. They make things that look like other things, and they do that really well. I think you could have the lava, sort of the born of fire kind of motif, be a big part of that. And maybe it's not just a collectible, like, hey, we're really good at carving, we make really nice little tribal statues to send over across the lake to sell to dumb tourists over in Dilith Lean. Maybe there's, you know, if they want to, maybe they're imbuing these things with power. And along those lines, I found a really cool entry in the fifth edition Monsters and Foes book, Tome of Beasts or whatever, their bestiary, is by Necromancer Games. I've cited a couple of things from it before. And this one is called a Lava Child. This creature is a stocky humanoid standing 5 or 6 feet tall with sooty black hair, green eyes, and flesh that ranges from pink to crimson. It sometimes wears clothing crudely fashioned from hides, sometimes goes naked. Its face has a curious, almost childlike appearance, and seems to be imprinted with a permanent, unchanging smile. And so, this is it's a humanoid, it's an elemental, it's a medium elemental, medium humanoid elemental, neutral. It's you get XP, 200 XP for this creature, and a challenge rating of 1. And I'll kind of go through some of the ecology is certainly the interesting thing, I think, about this. So, lava children make their lairs deep underground, and usually in warm areas, the warmer the better. Volcanoes, hot springs, thermal vents, and other geothermal areas are the most likely to attract lava children. They are reclusive and rarely have dealings with other races. The exceptions are with similar elemental structures and tolerance for extreme heat, such as magmen, salamanders, and azures. When they're drawn into combat, lava children attack with their clawed hands and vicious bite. That to me is a little bit boring. I would probably go a lot more with fire damage, personally. But that's what they give you. And there's a variation of the lava child that is a lava child shaman, which I think is what all the lava children in this Lovecraft world really want to be. I think they want to be magical beings constructed by these lava gatherers high in the mountains, maybe deep in a cave somewhere, underground, where the lava flows. And these beings are being constructed for whatever reason. You'll have to come up with your own motivation. But they would definitely have things like fireball and dancing lights and burning hands, magic missile, continual flame, scorching ray, you know, good magic fire-based attacks. So that's a really interesting one. It's completely not Lovecraft. It's just something that I'm taking ideas and running with them, really. But check that out. It's in the 5th edition Monsters and Foes book from Necromancer Games. And yeah, again, not actually Lovecraft. But I think it would fit in nicely. Okay, so getting away from the lava gatherers, at the end of the lower slopes of Granik, the ash trees and scrub oaks and shrubs become sparse, and the bare, hideous rock rises into the sky to mix with frost and ice and eternal snow. In some places, there are solid streams of lava, just completely, solidified. I was going to say frozen, but really it's just solidified lava from all the cold. And scoriae heaps litter slopes and ledges. The remains of abandoned camps, along with makeshift altars, built either to propitiate the Great Ones or to ward off what they dreamed of in Granik's high passes and labyrinthine caves, can be found scattered throughout. I just love the image of these higher, you know, you're getting past the low, obvious slopes of Granik. And when I say low, I mean, if you've ever been on a mountain, you know that it's all relative. So the fact that you've gone up the mountain this far, you think you're high up, but there's still, you know, way more above you. But you're past that low point, and you start getting into the snow, and you're seeing all these abandoned camps of lava gatherers who've moved on, you know. And then all of these altars, which you could make creepy, you could make reverent, I mean, you could do anything with them, but abandoned little makeshift altars, and who knows, were they there to ward away evil, or are they there out of reverence for some kind of ice goddess or something like that? It's up to you. And maybe that's where the lava children come in. Maybe it's all part of a fire-worshipping religion. Who knows? So higher still, where condors nest, the soil becomes meager and great patches of bare rock crops out. Even this gives way eventually to nothing but bare rock, weathered and rough, with knobs and ledges and pinnacles that somewhat help a brave adventurer ascend the great mountain. Even this high, there are signs of desperate lava gatherers in the form of carven footholds or abandoned quarries. Farther up still, there are caves and caverns, foreboding and pitch black inside. What path there is opens on sheer, perpendicular cliffs that are wholly unreachable by the feet of man. Even from this height, the far shores of Oriab cannot be seen, so large is the island. So Oriab, again, it's a pretty big island. We don't, I guess, know whether big means New Zealand big or Australia big, but it's big. Now, in the rough area of Gronach, and it doesn't really necessarily say what exact region these creatures dwell in. I don't know how high up they go, in other words, but on Gronach itself, there is some strange creature, unseen by man, that lurks around the base and perhaps along the cliffs of Gronach. It makes a webbed footprint, it moves silently, and may or may not have wings. It most certainly has fangs that are capable of piercing flesh, even like zebra flesh, and they drain blood. Such a creature can drain a zebra of its blood in less than a night, without the zebra making a sound, so they make quick work of it. Lovecraft doesn't provide any name for this. We get the distinct impression that it is not a Vunith, and that it is not a Nightgaunt, or at least I get that distinct impression, because when the narrator of the story mentions it to some lava gatherers he's camping out with at one point, they seem horrified to even imagine such a thing might exist. Whereas everything else they were fairly willing to talk about. So I didn't, you know, if it was something that's already been discussed, why would they be so scared of it? So I'm imagining it's something else. Now, I could be wrong. It could just be the Vunith, or it could be a Nightgaunt, and you'll hear more about Nightgaunts soon. But I got the impression that it was neither of those two things. It was something completely different. So I made up a monster. You can use it or not. It doesn't matter. It's not groundbreaking at all. In fact, it's based somewhat on the Chupacabra, which I got stats for out of the Monster and Foes book that I got the Lava Child out of. The Chupacabra in there is really, really good, really horrifying, excellent monster. It's very, very good. If you happen to have a copy of that book, or you can get one, it's on page 56. Really, really excellent little disgusting creature. But I needed to modify some things from that, and so I just kind of used that as a basis. And like I say, Lovecraft didn't give this thing a name, and again, he's not very clear as to whether it's even a distinct creature. So I called it a blood flutter. BLOODFLUTTER, which is not terribly Lovecraftian, so I'm going to just say that it's slang, local slang for these creatures. XP 200 for this, CR1, it's not a super great threat, I wouldn't think. I would say that it was probably neutral evil. And I'm going to call it a small creature, which, even with myself, it's kind of debatable as to, I mean, if you're a small creature, could you drain all the blood from a zebra? Possibly not, possibly, I don't know, it kind of depends. So, I don't know, maybe it's a little bit on the bigger side of a small creature, but I'm classifying it as a small creature. Just because I kept getting these ridiculous images of kind of this sort of, kind of silent film Nosferatu tiptoeing into camp and attacking the zebra. So I was trying to get away from that mental image. So I'm calling it a small creature, a nit bonus of 2, since dark vision 60 feet, perception plus 2, and AC 14, touch 13, flat foot 12. So that's, if you're, following along and doing the math, that's plus 2 dex bonus, plus 1 natural defense, plus 1 for its size. HP is 11, so that's 1 hit dice of 8 plus 4, and fortitude of plus 1, reflex of plus 2, will plus nothing. Speed is 20 feet, climb is 20 feet. Multi-attack. Attacks once with claws and once with bite. And the way this multi-attack works is that if it attacks with claws and it succeeds, then it gets a plus 4 on the damage roll, but more importantly, the target is grappled. Now, if you're grappled, then... Well, and then, so we can do the multi... The other multi-attack is the bite. So again, that's a plus 4 on its damage roll. But again, more importantly, if you are grappled while you are... And you are bitten while grappled, then it adds the bleed effect. And the bleed effect simply says that you get 1d6 bleed damage each round with a DC 15 to heal. So that can be really bad, but in terms of flavor for that for this monster, it's a must have. I mean, that's its specialty, is to bleed out its opponent. So bleed damage, I think, is just, it's got to be there. Aside from that attack technique, it's not a super powerful monster. It's a strength of 10, dex of 15, con 11, int 12, wisdom 12, and charisma 8. Doesn't get a base attack bonus. Combat maneuver bonus is nothing. And then combat maneuver defense, this is obviously stuff for Pathfinder, 12. I gave it a feat called flyby attack. When flying, a blood flutter can take a move action and another standard action at any point during the move. I feel like the book, the source text, implies strongly that it is a winged creature. It later says, oh, it doesn't have, it might not have wings, but or maybe it's just that we're not sure that what the main character felt was a wing brush his face or something. But I just feel like they've got to have wings. And if you have wings naturally, then I think you have a flyby attack, because it's just natural. It's what you do when you know that's how you move, as you fly. So the creature cannot take a second move action during a round when it makes a flyby attack. Skills are climb plus 10, fly plus 4, stealth plus 12. Language is none. It's just a little beast. It doesn't really speak. I mean, I guess you could argue that it has something like Sylvan or something, but I don't think so. Blood frenzy, once per day, if a blood flutter takes damage in combat, it can enter a frenzy in the following round for plus 2 con, plus 2 strength, but minus 2 AC. Frenzy lasts as long as the battle, or for 1 minute, whichever is shorter. And then finally, this is especially for Lovecraft flavor, I mean, as written flavor, is a skill, or a feat, rather, that I call Late Night Lull. And it says that if a blood flutter is encountered between sunset and sunrise, which is generally when they are encountered, players must make a DC 10 fortitude save or gain the drowsy condition in Pathfinder or the paralyzed condition in 5th edition. And this is something that I just kind of came up with to match what the book said, or what happens in the book, and that is that the main character, I mean, his zebra is being drained of all of its blood, not 2 meters away from him. So, well, maybe 3 meters away, but you know, it's very close by, and the guy doesn't wake up. And I'm assuming that what happened there was that he was magically affected, you know, like he was made to not wake up. And possibly, I mean, in order to subdue a zebra and suck all of its blood, I kind of feel like you'd have to subdue the zebra. So I don't see this little creature coming up to, you know, walking around the camp and attacking a zebra and draining all of its blood completely silently all on its own. So I'm saying that it has a magical aura of sorts, whereby if you're encountering it during the night, then you are highly subject to the possibility of being put into a magical slumber so that you don't wake up. I mean, maybe you wake up, but you're not fully awake, and you can't really bring yourself to go, you know, to get up and go do something. So I think that's kind of the the central theme of this creature, really, is that it is magically sleep-inducing, and then it sucks blood. Okay, so higher still, visible only after scaling a nearly impossible incline, is a carving in the side of Gronik of the polished features of a god, stern and terrible. It is the face of a god chiseled by the hands of gods, and it looks down haughtily and majestically upon anyone who finds it. It possesses long, narrow eyes and long-lobed ears, a thin nose, and a pointed chin. In the light of the sunset or sunrise, it shines as if though it was on fire. So this is the great legendary feature of Gronik that no one's really sure if it exists, but it definitely exists. It is also well hidden. It is way, way up on Gronik. It is on the dangerous side of Gronik, so you can't sail into Baharna, look up on Gronik, even with, you know, a natural 20 perception check. It's just, you're not going to see this thing, because it's on the opposite side, meaning you can't just go around and look up either, because on this same side there are craggly cliffs and peaks and rocks, so it's this super dangerous side of the mountain that you just can't quite get to all that easily. And then, as I say, it's pretty darn high up, and I imagine it's probably not like Mount Rushmore style, sort of like, here's a face on the side of the cliff. I imagine it's sort of, you know, there's the cliff, but then there's an inset, and then there's the god. So it is very difficult to get to. Now, again, this is the face of an actual god, so it is not an artist's representation. Well, it is an artist's representation, but the god was sitting as a model for this thing, you know, and another god created it, which presumably this all ties into the whole, you know, the lava gatherers and hill people are really good at making images, and I'm assuming that ties into this, the fact that they've got this image of an actual god carved into the side of their mountain. It's got to influence them in some way. And that's not the only people that it influences. So the face itself is said to be sort of akin to the features of the people of Selafe in Uthnargai. We haven't been to Selafe, or Uthnargai for that matter. That's way across the Serenarian Sea. We haven't even been over there yet. It's beyond the Tenarian Hills, so that's way beyond Thran and Kirin and the Jade Temple and all the, or Jasper Temple and all that stuff. So it's we have to go back around through the Enchanted Woods and up to get there. So it's quite separated from here, and yet people say that the gods, that this image in the side of the mountain has this weird resemblance to the inhabitants of Selafes. And one of the reasons for that, people suppose, is that that various gods living on Earth intermingled with some humans, and so kind of some of their genetic features got all mixed up, especially in the region of Selafe. Okay, so unfortunately this peak, as grandiose as it is, and I mean, I think discovering this peak should be a big deal. I mean, this face should probably grant magical powers or bonuses, or at least it should count as a long rest. You know, you find this place and bang, you're healed, whatever. So that's great, and it's quite the achievement, but unfortunately it is under the protection of creatures called Night Gaunts. Now, Night Gaunts are one of my favorite creatures in the entire book. They're really, really great. Super creepy and super cool. They protect the face, this carving of the face of God, but they, unlike a lot of the other creatures in this, a lot of the other bad guys in this world, they're actually not working for Nyarlathotep. They're not interested in protecting the elder gods or the old ones or anything like that. They actually serve this archaic god called Nodens, Nodens, and they love nothing more than to completely neutrally bring down prey that they find above Earth, above the ground, down through the caves and caverns of Granik, into the great abyss, or the underworld of the Dreamlands. So it is the Night Gaunts that take people, they grab them up, and they take them down, 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 way below the earth, drop them off in, for dolls and maybe ghouls to devour, and that's just kind of what they do. And we're not really sure exactly why they do that, because it's not something that they have, you know, they haven't been charged to do this. They're not protecting the interests of anyone. That's just what they do. And in a way, that's good, because actually, Night Gaunts are, they have a solemn treaty with ghouls. So if you've gotten to know some ghouls, and you start talking about Night Gaunts, the ghouls can give you a password to so that the Night Gaunts won't mess with you. Which means that you could actually leverage the Night Gaunts to be your friend, because they are treaty bound to help ghouls and friends of ghouls. Or maybe they don't know the difference between a ghoul and someone who just says the password, but they will actually help you as long as you know what key phrases to say to them. Night Gaunts are creatures with bat wings, inward curving horns, black, oily, almost whale-like skin. So it's kind of glistening and smooth and perfectly black. Their flight makes almost no sound, super stealthy, and neither do they. And they have no faces. They do have prehensile paws and barbed tails. So they're a little bit like a faceless Satan or demon, but they're completely black. And they're completely silent. They're able to pluck their prey from the ground and fly away with them. And like I say, they generally either drop you into, they take you down into the underworld, or I guess if they're not up for that journey, they'll just fly over, they'll fly with you over the sharp craggy rocks below Granik and drop you, and let the fall take care of you. Night Gaunts are things that everything is afraid of. And I mean everything. Everyone is afraid of them, except ghouls, but ghouls are ghouls. And everything, like even the Shantak birds, which we haven't met yet, we'll see them later in an episode more about the northern regions. But the Shantak birds are essentially dragons. They're big, terrifying, scaly birds that guard, pretty much they guard the entrance to the void. They guard the old gods in a way. And they're even afraid of Night Gaunts. So the Night Gaunts have to be pretty darned scary. And I think there's a lot of upward potential for Night Gaunts. I put them pretty far down on the scale of challenge ratings, because I don't know that they're necessarily the best fighters, but everything really, really is terrified of them. And we'll get into that once we get down into their special attributes. But generally, I figure experience points worth about 1,100, challenge rating of 4, neutral medium aberration, initiative of +3, which might even be on the light side, to be honest, dark vision 60 feet. AC is 13, touch 10, flat-footed 13, HP is 65, so that's 10d8 plus 10. And fortitude of +2, reflex of +3, will +2. Speed, 30 feet. Statistics would be strength 17, dex is 10, constitution's 14, int is 14, wisdom is 10, charisma is 10. Base attack is +1, CMB +4, CMD 14. For skills, they can fly +10, they can stealth +8, they have knowledge of the planes and knowledge of nature, both +4, and they have sleight of hand +8, and they specifically have a sleight of hand +8 because they are so silent that they can just, well, they can certainly, by the book, they can grab a scimitar out of your belt, like if you have your scimitar on you, they will just kind of pull it out and toss it over the cliff, because that's what they do in the book. And they do it completely silently. And in fact, in the book, they're standing right next to the main character, or maybe they're flying by the main character for who knows how long, and he only becomes aware of them because they take his scimitar. And I almost got the impression that they took his scimitar more because they were just like, this guy's never even going to notice us if we don't do something. Okay, so as feats, I've got Adrenal Surge. Twice per day as a bonus action, a Night Gaunt can accelerate itself so that it gains speed of 60 feet and AC 15, advantage on dex saving throws, and it can take one additional action on its turn. Effect lasts 1d4 rounds. Because they are stealthy and because they are winged, I figure combat mobility is a good idea. This makes such that opportunity attacks against a moving Night Gaunt always has disadvantage. Another one is Mind Screen. The mind of a Night Gaunt is chaotic and dangerous. Any attempt to read the mind of a Night Gaunt, or to communicate it with it telepathically, requires DC 16 intelligence saving throw. Or I guess you could do it against, like, Will or something. If failed, the player is driven insane. Your intelligence and wisdom are temporarily reduced to 3, with a DC 15 heal to recover. If successful, you still gain the confused condition for 1d4 rounds. So that's pretty intense, and I think that ought to be enough to scare several creatures right there, especially creatures that maybe have telepathic abilities. In accordance with that, they have Mind Sense. A Night Gaunt instinctively senses the intelligence of any creature within 60 feet. They also, like the Blood Flutters, they have a flyby attack because they have wings. And I just feel like if you've got wings, you would know how to do flying quite well. So when flying, a Night Gaunt can take a move action and another standard action at any point during the move. The Night Gaunt cannot take a second move action during a round when it makes a flyby attack. And then finally, it has Aura of Flight, which I just kind of came up with. So a Night Gaunt is surrounded by an aura of fear. All creatures within 60 feet must succeed a DC 10 fortitude save or gain the shaken condition in Pathfinder or the frightened condition in 5th edition. And honestly, 60 feet might be a little bit low, but I just figure it'd be kind of weird if your players were just standing around and suddenly you told them, oh, you have to make a save for this or else you're shaken, and they're just like, well, why, what is it, and they wouldn't even know. So it doesn't make sense to be too far away, so probably 60 feet is reasonable. I guess I feel like it's not reasonable because there are these parts in the book where the Night Gaunts are flying and the Shantak birds see them from way far away and just cower away in fear. It's really cool. They're really, really great monsters. I love the Night Gaunts, and you get a lot of Night Gaunt action in the second half of the book. Night Gaunts, as I say, can be reasoned with, as long as you are a friend of the ghouls, and the ghouls have given you the special ghoul password, or the ghoul, you know, sound of ghoulishness, so that you can convince the Night Gaunt that you are a friend and an ally of ghouls. There is some kind of solemn treaty that the Night Gaunts have with the ghouls. We don't know the history of it, but we do know that it does compel the Night Gaunts to fight to the death to aid a ghoul or a friend of a ghoul. They are not good with water. They will fly over water if they absolutely have to, and if I have to, I mean for their own survival. They will not tend to go too far out over the water, though. They like solid land underneath them. I mean, they like flying, but they like flying over land. They don't like to fly over vast bodies of water. But other than that, they're pretty fearless. They're pretty great. They fly straight into the void. Again, they're kind of compelled to do it because of the ghouls, so I don't know if they would have normally flown into the void, but they didn't seem too upset about it, really. So whereas they notably were upset about flying over an ocean or a sea. And that, like I say, everything is terrified of them. Nothing wants anything to do with a Night Gaunt. It's pretty cool, and I hope that my stat block didn't undersell them. I think you could really make them a powerful beast. And like I say, it's not that they are super powerful in combat. I don't get the sense that they are super powerful in combat. I mean, they have basically, from what I can tell, one trick, and that is that they fly, they pick things up, and then they drop them. Like, that's their combat trick. That's their combat maneuver right there. Aside from that, though, all that mental stuff, I think, adds to their punch, such that creatures that aren't super strong-willed are going to be terrified just by the sight of these faceless, glistening, human-sized demon bats and not know what to do with themselves. That is a Night Gaunt. And that's pretty much everything about Oriab that we have from the book. It's a pretty neat little island. I think you could go way past Granik and come up with the rest of the ecology yourself. There's a lot there for the telling. I mean, you could make it a great big fiery volcanic island. You could make it a tropical island behind Granik. That sometimes gets all kinds of lava downpour when Granik is angry. You could make it beautiful. You could do whatever you want to. But it's a big island, and there's a lot to explore. And there's a lot of story potential with a lot of the little hints of things going on, both in Baharna and in Yath, or in the city by Yath, and old Baharna, and then the different layers of Granik. Sounds like a really fun place to play around in and maybe develop for a story. So there you have it, everything I know about Oriab. Thanks for listening, and I will talk to you next time. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.